science and technology affects all of our lives in very profound ways. And given the pace of developments in the fields of science and technology, there doesn't seem to be any sign of slowing down. It's only going to get more and more. What I think concerns some scientists, people in the public policy field, is that often when we are thinking about adopting some new kind of technology, we're talking about the effects of technology on society, on the Earth, there is very little discussion. We don't seem to think very carefully about how what we do affects the environment, or if we're going to use some new kind of product. Maybe it's something newly engineered. Often the kind of reflection on whether or not we should do this thing is very, very small. And that may in part be due to the fact that many people feel a little shut out of that discussion. They somehow feel that they don't have the background or the experience or the knowledge to say whether they think one technology is good or not. And so this morning we'll try to take a look at how the general public participates or doesn't participate in this discussion about science and technology. Some people would suggest that it is our fault. It is the media's fault because sometimes our coverage of science and technology is either sensationalist or shallow. Some people might suggest that in part it's the fault of scientists, people who do the research who may not be very good at talking to people who aren't scientists, or that they aren't willing to take tough stands when those things are needed. And then, of course, there is the political leadership, which seems always to want ironclad statements one way or the other. And they say, well, the scientists, they don't like to give you ironclad statements, so we're just waiting, or we're waiting for more data. So we'll see if we can examine all sides of this business. As we talk with our guest this morning, her name is Patricia Hines, and she is director of the Institute on Women and Technology at MIT. She also teaches in the Department of Urban Studies and Planning there. And this is an area which she has thought about a lot and has written on. In addition to her experience at MIT, she also worked as an environmental engineer at the Hazardous Waste Division of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and also served as Chief of Environmental Management of the Massachusetts Port Authority. For her work in EPA's Superfund program, she won the 1985 Environmental Service Award of the Massachusetts Association of Conservation Commissions. She also, in 1987, won a German Marshall Fund Environmental Fellowship to do a comparative study of lead contamination and environmental policy in Western Europe and the United States, and is also the author of many scientific papers and several books that deal with environmental and policy topics. And her books include The Recurring Silent Spring, Reconstructing Babylon, Women and Technology, and Earthright, Every Citizen's Guide. And I'm sure that you can find them in library or bookstore if you'd like to go looking. We're pleased to have her joining us on this program today. And as we talk, if you have questions, comments, you want to give us a call, we welcome your participation in the conversation. 333-WILL is the local number. We also have a toll-free line, and that is 800-222-WILL. And thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
But perhaps before we start out examining the points of this triangle here, these sort of three parties that we're talking about, the political leadership, the scientific community, and the public, and include the media in that. Before doing that, maybe we should back up another step and ask, why does it matter? Why? What's the problem with the lack of communication that you see we have now?
Okay, I'll answer that by giving you some examples of where I have seen it matter. When I worked as an environmental engineer at EPA in the Hazardous Waste Program, and it was specifically the Superfund program, I was responsible, as were other environmental engineers, for specific hazardous waste sites where we might have a landfill with toxic contaminants in it, and the landfill is leaching some of those chemicals into groundwater, and perhaps a nearby town well is contaminated. I had a case like that. As we were studying the problem and then beginning to devise solutions for cleaning up the landfill, the leachate, and protecting the local town water, which in fact at that point was contaminated and the wells were shut down, it became apparent to me and to others working on their sites that the local citizens, the people whose well was shut down, the people who were living in the area and who were concerned that maybe other water supplies would be contaminated, the people who fished in nearby streams and swam in a local lake, these people felt that it was their lives, their community, their water resources which were ruined by this hazardous waste site, and that they should be part of the decision-making process, both in the design of the study of the problem so that they could make sure that the concerns that they had, the understanding they wanted of the impacts of this landfill were also designed into the study, but even more so that they were involved in the decisions about the cleanup of the site so that they could make sure that they were satisfied that the actions that EPA would take or force the responsible industry to take were sufficient to not only cover up the problem, which in many cases is what the types of solutions were, encapsulating the waste and leaving it in place, but that there were solutions that these people could then live with for the next 20 years. This insistence of being part of the decision-making in hazardous waste sites was not easily and well-received at first by EPA. The first response was that scientists and lawyers at EPA would probably know better than an uninformed public or an uneducated or a science illiterate public about what to do at these sites. So that at first there was resistance to it, and then there was only a marginal inclusion of these people. We would have a public meeting once all of our studies were finished and our conclusions were set, and we would hold the public meeting and present the conclusions to the people and call this public participation. And gradually, sort of through trial by error and baptism by fire, EPA, I myself learned on the job, as did others. I mean, we learned that public participation means involving those people who are impacted, who are victims of these sites, right up front at the beginning, and that holding educational sessions in which our scientists explain to people the genesis of the problem, the potential impacts, what cancer risks there were, etc., that you were able to then generate an informed public who could be partners with us in the decision-making on this site. So what I am saying is that I think that science decisions around environmental issues, which are issues that affect people's lives, in which people live and work, that these should be done in partnership with the public, and that the media has a very important role in this process, that the media is used by
Thank you.
That's where they're going to get their basic information. And in a sense, the media is sort of like the stand-in, I guess that's what we like to think, that you know, so we're representing the interest of the public. We're the people who are there, who have access to the officials and the scientists, and we're there asking the questions. I think one has to be honest and say that there are many reporters who are poorly equipped.
I know. I hear that regularly.
Science coverage.
Yeah.
And I think it's – I mean, I think one has to be honest and say I think – and I'm certainly not the first person to say it – that people become journalists because they're writers. And they don't do well with stories
and science
that
journalists are not numbers. Have not necessarily been trained in science.
That's right. It's also true of economic and business reporting as well.
Well, let me suggest something. I think besides I'm using media in a very wide way here, so I'm also talking about, let's say, television coverage of events as well as the written media, so electronic and print media. But, for example, I've read an analysis of the media coverage of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. I think there are things that media can do which do not require that they themselves have been trained in a particular background, but that still enables them to give the kind of in-depth coverage that I'm talking about. McNeil Lehrer, in covering the Exxon Valdez oil spill, was criticized by environmentalists for assembling a panel of experts to comment on the cleanup of that spill, and that panel of experts did not include environmentalists from prominent organizations who had been very active in commentary and evaluation of what they thought about Exxon's efforts to and EPA's responsibility for that spill. So I think that groups who are covering, or journalists who are covering, television which is covering a major event like that has a responsibility to at least assemble a fair panel of people and not just represent the industry side, which was what happened on the McNeil Lehrer coverage of the Exxon Valdez spill, which, of course, was more congratulating the industry for expending the amount of money that they did for the oil spill instead of criticizing them for being late in starting the cleanup. And also environmentalists would have brought a kind of realism to the situation of the oil spill. Realism meaning that in the history of oil spills, we have no history of the capability to contain more than 15% of oil spilled like that. So that this fantasy of cleanup, if we were just better prepared or acted more quickly or had double-hulled ships, which was portrayed in the media coverage of the oil spill and of the subsequent sort of discussion and analysis of what better, how much better could we clean up these spills. We were left 2 years later in media coverage with the idea that it was human error which created that tragedy, whereas in fact it's a mix of human error. Of course, there was some human error there, but also of a kind of institutional complexity in super transport, a super tanker transport of oil, which needs to be looked at. In other words, is it possible when you have a spill like that ever to clean it up? We were left thinking that if there were not human error, it would be possible to clean it up, and left then with the kind of whole international transport of oil via supertanker and dependency on fossil fuels somewhat intact because it was reduced to human error. Now, that type of coverage, I think, it can be undone if the correct assembly of experts, the correct mix of experts, those who are looking at the institutional issues that I'm talking about, the energy policy, our energy policy and dependency on oil, and not just add some technical fixes which, if done, could prevent this from happening again. So it isn't that you have to know all of this yourself. I think you have to know what needs to be known and who the mix of experts are or people are to put them together so that you can have the kind of complex and thorough coverage of an environmental event that we need to have in order for the public to understand is the solution that came out of that, which is being prepared to clean up more quickly than we did, double-hulled tankers, adequate solutions. Does that make super tanker transport of oil safe? We were left thinking that it will be safer in the future with no sort of historical understanding of oil spills, of the impossibility of cleaning up oil spills of that magnitude. And when you understand that, the sort of historical and institutional complexities, you then begin to question on another level the kind of dependency on fossil fuels and on transport of oil that we, as well as all of the industrial world, is hooked into, and the hazards, the risks that we take in doing that for the marine environment.
Our guest this morning is Patricia Hines. She is director of the Institute on Women and Technology and also teaches in the Department of Urban Studies and Planning at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And we're talking about problems in communication, communication of science and technological issues, and why it is that the public, that is the most, perhaps the most directly affected, doesn't have a way to participate more in the conversation. And in fact, sometimes there's not really much of conversation at all.
There's no invitation.
There's
no invitation. Let me give an example of another realm of decision-making about technologies in which people are not invited to participate as they are in making decisions about the cleanup of hazardous waste sites in their neighborhoods. That is now written into the hazardous waste law, that there has to be public participation in Superfund site cleanups and decisions about cleanups. But for example, currently the Food and Drug Administration is deciding on registering a genetically engineered bovine growth hormone, which will be injected into cows and which will make cows lactate at 10 to 25% the rate that they currently do. So it will increase milk supply per cow. This is a technology which has been developed by major companies like Monsanto, Eli Lilly, four major pharmaceutical companies, chemical companies in this country. It's a technology which farmers, dairy farmers, do not want. Many in the Midwest small dairy farmer associations have organized against the hormone, in part because, for them, because there is a dairy surplus and they already have depressed dairy prices and they don't need more surpluses. So they see it as a technology they don't need. It is also being organized against on the part of animal rights people who feel, and I agree, that it is a cruel technology for animals. It causes mastitis, heat stress, and wears them out in 2 to 3 years rather than their sort of normal life, now 5 years. And it's also being criticized by some health specialists who say that the milk that comes from those cows which are treated with this hormone will have some ingredients in it as a result, which we will then ingest. Humans consuming that milk will ingest. Which ingredients are different from the normal hormones that come into cow's milk, and which we are not confident will break down in the human body and instead may pass into the blood of humans. So that there are health experts who feel that there are certain risks with this milk coming from genetically engineered cows injected with the hormone. So there are three groups representing citizens, dairy farmers, animal rights people representing animals, and health experts on this, all of whom have coalesced to say we don't want this technology. But in fact, the FDA approval process does not invite public participation in the process, so that this type of protest falls on deaf ears with respect to FDA. And a criticism of FDA that was made internally by a veterinarian working for FDA in charge of the decision, this particular decision on this chemical, he publicly criticized FDA for being too pressured, he felt, and too allied with the industry that has manufactured this hormone. And he was fired from his job 2 years ago and is suing FDA to get reinstated. But this is a very good example of the process of registering new technologies and new products in this country, which basically has no citizen participation component, so that we have nothing to say about the new technologies that come on the market. I think this is an arena in which people should have more say. We should have a panel which advises FDA, which is comprised of citizens, a mix of people, and independent scientists and experts, people from the dairy industry in this case, but people who represent the interests who will be impacted by these new technologies coming on the market. So as I see it, the approval process for new drugs, new technologies, has really shut out the majority of the public, and that essentially they come on the market whether we want them or not, whether we need them or not, whether we feel that they are safe or not.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller to talk with. Let's do that.
Sure.
Here on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. It's very interesting. I'm glad to hear all this. As you say, it's not reported. The study on press coverage of Exxon Valdez, do you have a reference for that? Was that done by...
Yes. There is an article written by Lee Solomon. There's a second author with him whose name I've forgotten, but it was published in E! Magazine, E! For Environment, new journal that came out about 2 years ago. The article was published about 2 years ago. Solomon and the co-author are journalists who work for a project. I think the acronym is FAIR, but it has to do with fair reporting in the media. I believe it's a West...
It's,
what is it?
It's fairness and accuracy
in reporting.
F-A-I-R. And I think actually the two guys are... The one guy's name is Lee and Solomon.
Oh, sorry, it is. You're right. I collapsed them. It's Lee and Solomon. They work... The acronym is FAIR, the group that they work for on the West Coast. And they... actually, this is part of a larger article in which they analyze media coverage of the environment. And they have a nice analysis of the techniques used by media, techniques such as treating the environment as a monosystem rather than a complex system. And in the case of the spill, what they meant was that the spill is covered separately from energy policy, for example, split from it. But that article came out about 2 years ago in E! Magazine. So it's a new issue. It could be the first year that E! Was published, so I think you can find it pretty easily.
Okay. They also did the study of McNair-Lehrer that showed that...
That's right, yes.
I think for a period of 4 months they didn't have one environmentalist...
Yes,
on the
they're the ones that cited that. Yeah.
Right. A specific thing on the Valdez, didn't double-hull tankers get written into the law? Or
yes, it did. I think that was probably the primary net effect of all of the public discussion and political discussion about what should be the follow-up to this spill in order to improve the safety record of the industry. And As I recall, I think double-hulled tankers was probably the major change in industry. It was something that was written into the law, and I imagine it will be for new tankers being constructed.
So we have all these others that need to be retrofitted in some way.
That's right.
And they aren't building a lot right now. So anyway.
I'll just, if you're interested in this issue of super tankers and oil spills, give you another reference, which I think really rounds out the picture, and that's Charles Perrow's book. He's a sociologist at Yale, and his book is Normal Accidents. He has a section in there on the oil transport industry, super tankers in particular, looking at the history of accidents, looking at built-in sort of risks, which these one-by-one safety efforts and attempts like double-hulled tankers and better, quicker response time in terms of cleanups and spills. He analyzes how those can never make up for or undo the systems of risks and inefficiencies built into, the elements of risks and efficiencies built into the system of super tanker transport.
We could do well by importing less.
Well, that's the point, yeah.
Right. It was refreshing to see this, an astonishing bit on the Academy Awards, to see this short documentary award go to an attack on GE. And
I didn't see that. Tell me about it.
It was called GE, Nuclear Weapons in Our Environment, and the woman producer signed off by saying boycott GE, and of course it wasn't on NBC, but
One of the points that Lee and Solomon also make is how much of the major media is now owned by major corporate polluters, and GE owning NBC was one of the points that they made. I think it was interesting. It was very evident to me, without knowing specific ownership, around Earth Day 1990, it was very evident to me how much of major media, both television as well as magazines like Newsweek, Time, U.S. News and World Report, that all of the major polluters were carrying full-page ads featuring themselves as good corporate citizens in all of the major media. So it was clear it's both that they depend on their money for ads and sponsorship, but also that there's encroaching ownership of these of the media by these companies.
Every day is Earth Day with nuclear power as one of the themes. You were in the EPA during the Superfund scandal, were you? Is there anything that you...
Yeah, during the Reagan administration.
It was very interesting to hear anything you'd like to say. I've been enjoying it, but if there was anything that you had from the inside of the
No, I'll just give you my overview of EPA, which is, and I was asked this last night in speaking, that we now have almost 12 years, I would say. Yeah, we have 12 years at this point, two Reagan administrations and the Bush administration. And I think that clearly there has been an erosion of the original vitality, the mission. I think it started out as a very idealistic agency, somewhat independent in its mission of the legislative and executive branch. And that has genuinely been eroded in the past 12 years so that it is dictated to by the executive office at this point. And I think that you still find that there are good people attracted to work in it, and it has the same sort of pyramid structure as every other hierarchy, so that at the base you do have quite well-educated, well-intentioned, idealistic attorneys and engineers, but that they are thwarted by middle and upper-level management, which has been silenced, I mean, genuine gag order, I think, on that agency by the executive office with respect to whatever issue they choose to gag them on. This past year, it was wetlands. I think in the coming few years, it's going to be biotechnology policy. The White House, the Council on Competitiveness, is dictating the parameters of regulation that EPA is currently writing on biotechnology to ensure that the regulations do not inhibit the entry of commercial products onto the market. So I see EPA as being increasingly kind of tied up by its relationship to a conservative government that essentially sets up industry against environment, and when it has to, favors industry over environment, and EPA is somehow put in the middle of that. Consequently, I think that The kind of mission to protect the environment that EPA originally started out with has been taken over by nonprofit, very professional nonprofit environmental groups who now hire the cadre of attorneys, engineers, scientists that used to be attracted to work for EPA, that they're more attracted to work for these other organizations who are kind of taking over the vacuum of environmental mission of environmental protection, not diluted by a protectionism towards the economy that EPA is currently stifled by.
This morning our guest is Patricia Hines. She's director of the Institute on Women in Technology at MIT. She also teaches in the Department of Urban Studies and Planning there. And we're talking about why it is that often the public is not a participant in discussions of new technologies and scientific issues, and how perhaps we can improve that situation and get people more involved, give them a greater voice and a greater role. If you have questions, comments, we welcome them. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. We have someone else to talk with, someone on our toll-free line.
Yes, hello. Good morning. Mm-hmm. Whatever happened to the case of this Karen Silkwood against Kerr McGee, where she was contaminated by nuclear, I don't know whether it was dust or whatever it was. And the government is actually the biggest polluter of anyone in the United States, especially at all these Army and Navy and Air Force installations. There's hundreds of thousands of acres that have been polluted that will probably never, ever be decontaminated. I watched a program in the Rocky Mountains, how it's been all the water and the everything else, the earth has all been polluted. Now, we're going to pay a terrible price for what we've done to our environment in the last 25 years. And who's going to take care of all these people after they come down with these diseases that, you know, hospitalization is so expensive today?
I agree with you in terms of the extent of contamination from military facilities. I think that I want to link this back to the Persian Gulf War last year. I think that people, which, you know, so many people suddenly rallied around in a kind of understandable way, I think that people do not fully understand that the legacy of war and military buildup that we have been involved in for decades is a thoroughly contaminated country. The Department of Defense and Department of Energy are now known to be the major polluters in the United States as a result of contaminated military facility sites, Army, Navy, and Air Force. And this is something which is a kind of civilian counterpart of war elsewhere, that we, through war, destroy other countries and other peoples, but actually in this kind of quiet, invisible way, which has never been acknowledged until the past few years, we have contaminated our own country more than all the industry in the United States. Defense facilities have left their waste in groundwater, in soil, in people.
What is the answer?
Well, the federal government has to take responsibility for cleaning up those sites. They know the sites now. They've been listed.
Have they ever taken any responsibility that you know of?
To clean up their own waste?
Anything.
They take responsibility for war very well. I mean, I think if they could redirect their capacity for militarism back to cleaning, declare war on waste, for example, that perhaps they would be more successful in cleaning it up. I mean, turn these people who are trained to do war into basically cleaning up the military defense sites, your graduates from West Point, et cetera. I mean, it is possible. We know that it is possible to do. We have the technical knowledge. It is a question of political will.
We don't have the money. That'll cost trillions of dollars.
Redirect defense spending into cleaning up, into war on the environment.
I really don't think there's any hope. Because, you know, in the last 100 years, we've just been putting pollution upon pollution. And now it's starting to affect the food chain and the health of the people. Now, a lot of these new diseases that we're coming up with today, how do we know that some of those weren't actually started way back?
I know. We don't know that. I like this distinction, though, that has been made by Herman Delia, an economist who works at the World Bank. He says that while he is not optimistic about the way humans live on the earth and pollute the earth, in particular this government and military, nonetheless, not being optimistic, he is hopeful that he has not lost hope. And I do think that I like that distinction, because I think there's nothing to be optimistic about, but that at the same time that we must have hope. That's a quality of the heart.
Thank you.
Oh, sure. Thank you for the call. Other comments or questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. We have not talked, we've talked about the media, we've talked some about government. We haven't really talked very much about the scientific community and their side of this triangle that we started out talking about. You know, I think that we talked about the fact that there are a lot of journalists who end up covering scientific stories that aren't very well equipped. And I think, you know, one of the things that you will hear from reporters is that it's not always very easy to talk to scientists. Reporters, you know, they're trained to want the bottom line. They want the bottom line. And the scientists, sometimes for good reason, don't have a bottom line to give. And I think it is sometimes frustrating, not only for reporters, but I think for the Republic generally, that scientists sometimes take an attitude that says, look, my job is to supply the data. Here is the data. There it is. And what they would like to is for scientists to take more of a stand of saying,
policy.
Interpret the data.
Draw a conclusion from it.
And then say, you know, give
Make
some
a recommendation.
Guidance. Right.
Yes.
And that all too often scientists, they...
This clean split between science and public policy that I was talking about.
Right.
Well, I know what you have just portrayed is a kind of stereotype, and you did that deliberately, which has, of course, some truth in it. Otherwise, we wouldn't even have the stereotype. I would like to point out some contradictions or examples of scientists who have actually gone very far with data that was not yet complete, Rachel Carson being one of them when she wrote Silent Spring. Mm. On the one hand, she said that when she did a research on DDT, she found, and she started in 1958, that since 1950, documented in science journals was the fact that DDT was now being found in the food chain, that it was in mother's milk, and that it was being transmitted to infants at levels that were higher than were allowable in commercial food. As she read this, she said, how is it that scientists have published this in journals, but that the public and the government does not know? And she concluded that scientists, but she said especially she found professional men. Now, she was one of the only women in science at the time that she was working and writing. All her colleagues were male. But they were reluctant to say something with certainty or say something until they felt certain about it, that there was an unnecessary reticence and caution on their part. On the other hand, she was trained as a scientist. She was a marine biologist. And she wrote Silent Spring in certain sections of it, especially the human toxicity. What she did there was take what was not yet certain and say that if this is the case, it's what we're doing with global climate change models currently, if it is the case that this will cause an increase of cancer, then we have cause for alarm. So she wrote Silent Spring with some knowledge intact, that is, that robins were dying of eating worms that had biodegraded leaves that had pesticides on them, the food chain phenomenon. At the same time, the full impact on humans and the capacity to sort of document human cancer, because it takes so long for that to be the case. She did not have that evidence in hand, but that she did not back down from making very tough arguments against the use of potentially cancer-causing chemicals in the food supply. So we have the example with her of a scientist who is willing to go farther without full certainty of the effects and also risk being criticized by the science community for not being sufficiently reticent with things that were not yet proven. Today, as I pointed out in my talk last night, there is a similar situation that I see, which is it is global climate change scientists who are working at top levels in government and at universities who have models in which they are trying to predict possible increases in temperatures as a result of carbon dioxide emissions, for one, and who are saying that even without full certainty, that we should operate on a precautionary principle in public policy. That is, our governments, industrial countries' governments, should be committing to a policy of conservation, energy conservation, turning to renewable resources, moving out of dependency on fossil fuels, etc. So they are actually pressing the federal government to declare national policy on the use of fossil fuels as well as conservation. This is unprecedented, virtually unprecedented, where it is scientists without full certainty operating with a high probability but not full certainty who are calling for a different principle of public policy. The public policy should be made in this case with a precautionary principle. That is, if the likelihood of this, if there is a likelihood that we will see global climate change, a probability of it, and if the risks of that are sufficiently great, then we should act with precaution so that whether we have certainty or not, we should take action to reduce the causes of global warming. That's coming from the science community. It is not coming from the politicians who are running the country. It's coming from selected legislatures and Congress, but certainly not from the executive office. The United States has been the most lackluster of industrial nations in terms of committing to energy efficiency, to reduction of the use of dependency on fossil fuels, to investing in alternative energy. There's a very stubborn head in the ground protectionist policy that this government is engaged in under the rubric or aegis, and I think it's actually a fake excuse of protecting industry. Everybody knows that energy conservation would actually help industry. It's cheaper to run. If you put in cost-cutting measures, energy conservation or cost-cutting measures, you and pollution prevention measures, you actually save money per unit of product. So I think it's a kind of hubris that this country has enjoyed in being above being told what to do by the rest of the world, especially countries from the South. So that this government has deliberately ignored even the collective wisdom of other industrial countries, which are committing to energy efficiency in the industrial and domestic sectors because of being concerned about the likelihood of global warming. But to get back to your point, that actually is coming from the science sector. Mm. Now, a point that I also would like to follow up with here is that I think that scientists are not a homogeneous group. The scientists are constrained not only by the caution inherent in the method and by the habit of not drawing conclusions until they are absolutely certain. I think that's been one constraint. But I think an additional one, which is an increasing constraint, is that most scientists are not independent, that they depend on research money increasingly from industry, but also that the Department of Defense has been a major source of research monies for scientists. And therefore, if two-thirds, four-fifths, nine-tenths of scientists are captured by defense money or federal government money and or federal government, DOD money, DOE money, or by corporate money, then they are constrained. They feel constrained to both do the research to get the results that their donors want them to get, but also never to speak out on policy that may oppose the directions of the technologies that they're doing research on. I'm not excusing or defending scientists. I mean, I think they need courage and they need to free themselves from the kind of loyalties that this type of money fetters them to. But I'm saying that that's the condition of most scientists at this point. So it is not just science method, I think it's the source of funding that silences them.
We're coming to the point here where we have just about 6 or 7 minutes, and I do have a couple callers. I want to try to get at least one, maybe both, before we end up out of time. So let's do that. Let's go to line one. Hello.
Yes, sir. You mentioned the FDA, your guest did. And several years ago, I lived in Springfield, Illinois, and North 6th Street, parallel to St. John's Hospital, which is on 7th Street, in a private home. Gray stucco house is minister's last name is Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, and he had large folders, pale blue with bright red print, that mentioned the specific chemicals that are put in beer and do not have to be put on the label. And that's why, again, the FDA is in question, because that does include food and drugs. Thank you.
Okay. Is that something that you can comment? Maybe not the specific issue.
I think
it
was good enough in itself.
Okay, let's go on to someone else. Our line number two is next. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a question. I was wondering how your guest feels about the evolving relationship between universities and the corporate sector. I know here in Champaign with the Beckman Institute, there's a lot of private industries such as Eli Lilly and large corporate concerns coming in and being intimately involved in cutting-edge type technology using supercomputers and, you know, coming into an area where of the universities which used to be kind of a pure science or mm-hmm. uninfluenced type of thing, and it seems with money constraints and all this that how much, you know, we're losing some of the pure science. Mm-hmm. It's all becoming influenced by big dollars and things that possibly are self-serving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think you, in a sense, have answered your own point, but I'll just add a couple of things to it. I know that some critics feel that science is completely compromised when money is taken from industry and then the purpose of science is to develop commercial or patentable products. I don't have that absolutist position on science that it is automatically sullied when it's engaged in technology development for commercial purposes. I think our country has always operated that way, that science has always been done in support of technology. It's more overt now with these monies coming into universities. However, one problem that I see is that when scientists take money from industry, that it does end up, as I said earlier, silencing them in the sense that it becomes almost impossible to stand against, let's say, a technology development that the scientist may not believe in. That's one problem. The other problem I see is that the mainstream directions of technology are shaping science so that it is almost impossible for scientists to do alternative types of science. In mechanical engineering, for example, in any department across the country, there is very little, if any, money for wind power, wind dynamos, for example, or solar energy, money that was there in the 70s. And consequently, scientists, mechanical engineers, genuinely interested in creating a different future for energy technology simply don't have the funding either from the federal government or the commercial sector to do it. My concern, as much as that money shapes, the money that comes in shapes the technology and science that's done, and a lot of that is problematic. That's one problem I have with it. It's not money itself. It's the type of technology it's shaping. The second problem I have is that it has become impossible to do science without money. And so the types of science directions or technology directions we feel the country should go in order to do sustainable agriculture, in order to do alternative energy, public transportation systems over the car, we simply don't have the research going on because there's no either public or private monies to support that research. So that deficit of proper science research, which is not funded either by the private or public sectors, I see as equally problematic as the one that you were addressing.
We're almost out of time. We have perhaps about a minute or so. We really haven't, I suppose we have talked, but maybe indirectly, about the government side of the triangle. And I suppose one wonders with some sense of frustration how it is that we might get government to be a little bit more visionary mm-hmm. and a little less plotting in responding to some of these issues.
I'll give you simply one example. The USDA gives research money to land-grant universities, which I'm sure this university also gets. And that research money from USDA currently favors biotechnology research in agriculture. It could shift in priority so that the majority of the money would go into sustainable agriculture, integrated pest management, the type of science that's needed in order to prove that sustainable agriculture is commercially viable. We know it's commercially viable, but it needs additional research. USDA funding priorities are really shaping the direction that agricultural research is going in. So if citizen participation into that process of who gets money for what kinds of research could shift the priorities so that the majority of research money from USDA was going into sustainable agriculture, that's a very good example of how can we use government to enable us to shape the kind of future society that we would like. But we do need to work for, I think, an increasing democratic voice, and which is not simply electing someone president, that representative democracy that obviously has failed in this country. We need genuine participatory democracy, and I think that at this point it's only coming from grassroots activism around environmental, animal rights, consumer issues, that we need to coalesce and develop a strong grassroots voice that then enables us to be citizens and participants in the democratic process here.
Well, there's where we leave it. I want to thank you very much for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Our guest this morning, Patricia Hines, teaches in the Department of Urban Studies and Planning at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She is also director of the Institute on Women and Technology there at MIT.